Pascale Sablon knew from a young age that she wanted to be an architect. One of only two Black women in her history of architecture class, it was early days in her freshman year when the professor called on her to stand.
So there's a level of geeky excitement that was on my face that I just want you all to envision. But in one of our architecture history classes, the professor asked me and another student to stand and said, okay, these two will never become architects because they're Black and because they're women.
That moment shook Sablon, but it also cemented her purpose. Now, as CEO of visionary architect Sir David Ajaye's New York office and president of the National Organization of Minority Architects, Sablon is dedicated to helping women and people of color not only challenge a broken system, but dismantle it.
Hi, I'm Pascale Sablon, and this is a lesson on owning your own narrative.
So tell me, what is your earliest memory of being creative?
What a great question. My earliest memory of being creative is my mom always had collected these incredible interior design magazines. And I would take her shoe boxes, dump out the shoes, and I would staple and pin and couple together a few boxes to make like a floor plan. And then I would take index cards and create like little door swings, and I would orient them inside the box and then tape some of the pictures from the interior design magazines that kind of laid out some designs of subspaces. But I remember that was like a lost, like early childlike memory of just being playful and playing with space and design. But in general, I was always an artist. I was always drawing something, illustrating something. I always loved art and creativity. And that actually was fun because I used to be a little ballerina. And my brother, Jeffrey, was taking art classes. And I think one day the ballet class got canceled or something. So I just went with Jeff to his art class. And she was like, sure, she can come for a session. No big deal. And I was like, this is what you get to do? And I was like, Mom, I don't want to do ballerina stuff anymore. I want to go to art class. And she's, I've invested so much in your tutus and these years of ballet classes and gave it all up to do the art classes with Jeff. I guess those are some of my early fun memories as it relates to art and design and being creative.
I love that. Was she a designer?
No, my mom's an accountant.
Oh, an accountant with a hidden, probably a hidden visual sense in there. If she's two kids who are artists for sure. Okay, love that. So you're being creative when you're younger. What makes you decide you're going to be an architect?
I was a camp counselor at the Pamanoc Camp Center in Queens, and really had fun with the art program that they had there, and would always help my little ones that I was overseeing with their projects and just like creativity, and even made their costumes for the play. If you could find that picture somewhere, hilarious. But anyway, somebody might have been dressed up as a gigantic Sebastian and made a whole bunch of little mermaids dancing. But the art teacher and one of the camp directors just noticed my love for art and gave me a whole wall to draw a mural.
Oh, that's incredible.
And so I'm 11, 12 years old. And I decided to do this jungle gym with this multicultural community as like my piece. And I was drawing the jungle gym and somebody walks by and goes, wow, you could draw straight lines without a ruler. That's a great skill for an architect to have. And this individual was literally having this out loud thought, but it was just like, oh, I always thought about art as a hobby that was separate to what my career would need to be. And so in that moment, it occurred to me that I could do both, right? Like, and merge them, and it could be one and the same. And I truly love this concept of drawing something or having something in my mind and having it create into a space where people have to impact and engage with it. And so since I was 11, 12 years old, I knew that I was going to be an architect. That was my answer whenever somebody said, what are you going to be when you grow up? So nobody is surprised. That is what I ultimately chose to do as a career path.
And it takes a long time to become an architect. I don't think people realize quite how long it takes. It's pretty much the equivalent of becoming a doctor in many respects, right? Can you talk about your education path to that?
Sure. So I definitely did an interesting path, and I'll share the nuances as it goes, and then also hold the caveat that things have absolutely changed since I went through that process way back in the day. But it began with a bachelor's degree in architecture, and that's a BArch. And that's actually a very rare degree to obtain. Not many schools actually offer that because it's a 5-year bachelor's degree and it's an accredited degree. So that means once you complete that degree and you complete your internship, you would be able to sit and take the exams. Most schools offer a master's in architecture, which is an MArch. For me, after I finished my BArch, my mom required me to get a master's degree.
Can I just ask you about that for a minute? Why did she require you? What was that about?
Sure. My mom said a few things. The first was, when you first graduate, you're young, you're cheap, and you're easier to get a job. But once you're in an industry, it's very easy for you to get surpassed by other people in terms of promotions and a level of authority. And to be quite honest, the demographics of the profession, she wanted to make sure that I had all my paperwork in place so that nobody can question my ability or my capabilities to be there. And then lastly, she said that my family would be in a position to support like me staying in school just a little bit longer to complete that degree. So I graduated from Pratt in the spring of 06, and a week later started my master's program at Columbia, and then graduated in the spring of 07 with my master's degree. So I say all that to say, so that took me a 5+1, which is 6 years to get the degree. But again, most people do a 4-year bachelor's degree in something else, and then a 3-year master's program, an MArch, to make it a total of 7. So that takes a little bit more time. Then we have something at the time was called IDP for me, which was the internship process. Now I believe it's called AXP, where you ultimately have to do about 3 years plus or minus of internships. But that years is really connected to different phases of a project. And you have a supervisor who's saying that you're getting the kind of training you need to accomplish that. Then you take your exams.
So right.
During my time, if you took an exam, it took 6 weeks before you received the result. And then if you did not pass, you had to wait 6 months before you could take that chapter or that section again. So it took me 14 tests out of the 7 before I passed all that I was required. And there was also something called a rolling clock, which means once you passed your test, you had 5 years to pass all of the other tests or they start to expire. So that was another kind of pressure point. I bring that up because through the collaboration of NOMA and NCARB, we were able to do a survey baseline on belonging and identified some of the key kind of things that were challenging our membership in terms of getting licensure. And part of it was having their exams expire. And so I believe last year, if not the year prior, so forgive me, NCARB, but shout outs to you, they expired or removed that requirement as it relates to it. So people are able to continue to take the exams and pass accordingly.
And NOMA is the National Organization of Minority Architects. What's NCARB?
So NCARB stands for the National Council of Architectural Registration Boards, and they oversee the legal constitutions as it relates to become a registered architect in the country. And so they really lead the efforts in terms of taking exams and the requirements and making sure that you fulfill all the requirements of your jurisdiction. Becoming an architect is one that is quite lengthy from the time you, let's say, graduate from high school to the time that you can consider yourself a practicing architect. I think according to NCARB is 11 to 12 years. And for me, it took me 13 years just because of the struggles that I had with the exam process and I needing to wait the 6 months, which also is another rule that NCARB was able to remove.
I wanted to bring up that story of just the length of education for a number of reasons, because there is that mentorship aspect in there. There is, now fortunately your family was able to support you financially during the master's portion of that, but there is a lot of, I guess, assumed wealth in that time. And also the fact of, you know, when you're being mentored by somebody, that you're going to find somebody who is going to be interested in you, invested in you, in whom you can see yourself.
There is a privilege of studying and becoming an architect. And so some of the collaborations between NOMA, which I am the global president of right now, and NCARB and other anchor institutions that really control the profession, were identifying some of those challenges and finding ways to remove obstacles in a way that doesn't reduce the requirements in any way, but makes it more attainable for more people. And even some of the projects, when you take the exams, there were certain projects they needed to memorize, who were the architects. Even making sure that there was projects that were of diverse professionals within there was also something quite important. And so even the study of what questions are being asked, NCARB has taken a really great effort and initiative of making sure the exam itself is equitable.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. 5% of Black students go into architecture, only 3% graduate. And that is a powerful statistic. And then you mentioned that 7 HBCUs are the ones that are feeder schools to architecture as well. I've seen you
talk about that. Yeah, I think I got it from Robert Easter, who actually won the Whitney M. Young Jr. Award more recently, shared about the importance of HBCUs in the pipeline of architecture and diversifying the profession. And those 7 HBCUs output, I believe, 60 to 65% of African-American students who graduate with a degree in architecture. So when we were talking about how can we make the most significant impact in terms of creating diversity there, part of that strategy was to focus on some of those schools as well. Whereas the rest is kind of like my experience, where we're one of two or one of three in the entire School of Architecture that is participating in that experience. And that comes with its own challenges.
You're in your first year at Pratt. You are there for your BArch degree, as we just discussed, mm-hmm. and you are asked to stand. So tell me about that story.
Sure. So since I shared that I've always known that I want to be an architect, I was actually quite eager to start architecture school. And part of the reason why I wanted to go to a BArch program is that I knew first year, first day, I would jump into architecture projects. So there's a level of geeky excitement that was on my face that I just want you all to envision. But in one of our architecture history classes, the professor asked me and another student to stand and said, okay, these two will never become architects because they're Black and because they're women. And I remember being very surprised that the professor made that statement. Mm. And it wasn't being reprimanding in any way. It wasn't like we were being disruptive in class, but it felt for him like it was pure facts based off of what he had experienced, right? I also was also taking stock of the large classroom and all the students in there, and that actually there was only me and one other person who fit that criteria. And also the silence of my peers, right? Like it didn't impact them. They didn't seem to be outraged by it. And so it surprised me and it shook me. And I sat down and the person to my left, I'll never forget him, Simon C., he turned to me and said, "You better not let that be the reason that stops you. Prove him wrong." He used mm-hmm. way more colorful words, but that's what he said. And as a very competitive person, that was the sentence I needed to hear. But I often talk about that moment because it was, you have to understand, I grew up in Queens in an area called Cambria Heights, which was like 99% Black, 97% Haitian. Mm-hmm. I then went to an all-girls Catholic preparatory high school.
Me too.
the Mary Lewis Academy. And so I was always taught how great I am and how amazing I am because of these things. And so to kind of come into a space and told that I'm inadequate because of them was just very jarring. And it also made me take stock that I am a rare representative. And so therefore the responsibility of what it means when I show up into a space, that I'm not just showing up as Pascal, but I'm representing my gender, my race. And what does that mean? If I have a stomach ache, it's not, oh, no, I can't miss that class. I can't be like, Black girls don't go to class, right? So I had to really be mindful of what my performance meant. And I wanted it to always be the catalyst for more opportunities rather than limiting them.
I was watching a video presentation of you tell that story, and I was like, I gasped, and then I had to calm myself down. I don't want to spend time on that person. But were they fired? Were they reprimanded? Did they just get away with that?
At the time, it didn't even occur to me to report it, right? It just was like something that I just understood to be like the new reality of things. And I also identify that moment as a moment of privilege, because it was the reason I can speak to it is because it was the one and only instance I ever had to deal with it. No other teachers, no other class, even in his class, did he ever bring it up again.
I think what's also interesting, I will say though, it's interesting when you give this presentation, you say that you ask people, have they ever experienced it? And there's always somebody in the audience who's, and I've had an experience similar as well, very similar in that way. And I feel like this is who gives people the right to make these decisions?
What I recognized from him was his lived experience of what he had understood. And that's why some of my purpose was developed around elevating the work and identity of women and people of color. Because when you think about the professionals and the great architects we're told to learn from and to laud are all white male. Mm-hmm. So it also revealed a very big gap. And so I knew at that point, I couldn't just come into the profession and be an architect, but I had to also change the profession as well and create part of my advocacy arm of who I am and how I present in the space. And to your point, whenever I do share that story, I do ask the audience to stand so that people could see how very common. It's one thing to see me, who you don't know, on stage say it, and then it's another to kind of see your coworker stand up and your mm-hmm. boss stand up or your daughter stand up, and it becomes a conversation.
It's like Me Too. It's very much like Me Too that men could not believe, right?
We're starting to get at those kind of processes. Like, what is the process when injustices occur? What's the position of accountability that we're able to address? And just really leveraging what we're hearing from our members, from our students, to understand what are some of the challenges that they're facing and be able to address that and create systematic changes that then removes more obstacles and creates a more equitable and pleasant path to architecture in the profession.
Tell me about your Google search.
We do a series of project pipeline camps, architecture camps for NOMA. It's a global initiative that we have. And these kids are so excited to learn about architecture and design something and present to their parents. And they're skipping out the door going, saying, I'm going to be an architect. And what happens when they try to further that research and go further? What happens when they Google the words great architects? And so I ran that search and Google comes up with a banner, like an image banner of just names and faces. I went through the first 50. And at the time, only one was a woman. Zaha Hadid.
I was going to say, I bet you it was Zaha Hadid.
Zero were African American. And I'm looking at this list, and some of the names on this list is Michelangelo and Raphael. And saying that no woman, only one woman has had significant impact and no Black person, absolutely not. That's flawed. The very audacious Pascal went to the Google headquarters and met with their BGM group and walked them through what I was seeing and trying to understand why. And they said, Pascal, there's literally not enough content out there that lists you all as great. And simultaneously, I had been curating and hosting a series of exhibitions called Say It Loud. These Say It Loud exhibitions elevate women and people of color of that location. So it's a traveling activation, I like to call it. Mm-hmm. And we've hosted 47 exhibitions since we started in 2017. And we have elevated the work and identity of 1,112 diverse designers globally. Inspired by that response from Google, I then created the Great Diverse Designers Library, and the mm-hmm. titling being great is on purpose because the SEO didn't have nothing.
It's gonna great, build so it up. Yeah. Great.
Everybody's great. Bio was updated to say the great architect, the great urban planner, the great mm-hmm. landscape designer, the great interior designer, to challenge and create a space where we are being elevated. And when you look at the work, you're like, oh my goodness, this is extraordinary. This is great. And to get a level of comfort of being told you are great, because we are very much challenged by hearing that and shy by that and actually step away from that. But mm-hmm. at the same time, do not hesitate to digest other mainstream
messages. That's right, because those messages are pervasive. But just the idea of who controls the conversation. Who controls the conversation? I do want to move into a little bit of that, because you do speak to, it's the pride, but it's also how to deal with the media, how to tell your story in the media, getting comfortable telling your story in the media. And one of the examples you brought up was the erasure of Justin Garrett Moore in an article and then a video presentation for Architect Magazine. And I was, again, in complete shock. Who decided that was a good idea? But if you want to, could you tell us that story?
Sure. So during the AIA conference, when it was in New York, they had a panel. AIA and Architects Magazine had a panel in their expo that had different architects and designers and planners. And Justin Garrett Moore, I think, was part of the center of kind of creating that panel and had a beautiful voice. And it was about five designers on the stage there shortly after the video of the lecture was then posted on the official website. And in that video, Justin Garrett Moore, who was seated center stage.
And he's the only Black architect.
He's the only Black architect and planner, recently elevated to fellow of APA, so I'm very proud of him, was completely edited out of the video. And so that means any mention of him, introduction of him, any responses of any of these questions, the camera angles in which they use, and the only time you catch him is his shadow silhouette when they zoomed into one of the other speakers. And what was powerful is that he reached out and said, what's going on? Why did this occur? And he received very limited feedback. And then 2020 occurred, George Floyd. And then they put out an article that basically implies an accidental erasure of Justin.
That is not an accident. And then, so to me, oh my God, yeah.
So to me, it's like, you know what? I can't Photoshop a curl that doesn't take a few minutes, let alone editing out a whole person's existence from a panel. And so I was saying to people that it's not just being intentional about framing our narrative and making sure that we're in places and speaking to our projects and our what we're working on, but also fighting the force of erasure, that there's an actual force of those who are editing us out of the spaces and the credit that we are often due. When Steve Lewis always says, who will tell our story? And my answer is us. We have to tell our own story. We need to document. So when you finish a project, don't just sit and hope that Architizer or Architect Magazine or whomever is going to pick it up. You make a PDF, you make a document, you send it over, you push yourself out there and allow us or people like myself who are very happy to elevate you to continue to do that with all of our energy and all of our resources.
We need to prove that we exist. We exist. There's a reason now that we are telling those stories and that we should have been telling them.
Florida.
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason that we know them now is because we have started to tell them, because we are believing that we're valuable. And I think women in particular struggle with this notion of, are we valuable? Is our work valuable? Is it valuable enough comparatively to men?
So and I appreciate that alley-oop, and I'm going to take it.
Yes, yeah.
I keep thinking about all this rich content that I received through all these exhibitions, and I love the website, and I'm so proud of it, and really proud of the support that I got from the Sarah Little Turnbull to actually turn the designer's library into a searchable engine. But I also think about, like, how can I continue to think about that experience? And so I'm publishing a book. And the book is called Greatness, Diverse Designers of Architecture. And it's divided into four typologies. And it's focusing on how each typology has been used to harm in the past and how architecture and design and planning can heal. And then curate 10 amazing projects from our library that is of that typology and addresses some of those concerns.
Can you give me an example of one that you love?
Sure. I have to be careful because nothing's out there.
It's right. Keeping that in mind. Yeah.
We featured projects that have great community engagement processes. So maybe sometimes not just necessarily the end result or the project itself, but also the process in which we are able to receive or end at the design strategy. It's a global publication and it's leveraging the same kind of language that we talked about. And I remember when I was negotiating different book deals with different publishers to try to make it come to fruition, some publishers were like, nobody's going to care. We don't need a book about this. And the last book that I could come across that was featuring people of color was Jack Travis's book that he published in the 1990s. And so the idea of having more books that just celebrate our work and who we are was something that I became very passionate about. And another publisher said to me, I don't want any white women in your book. That there's enough books about white women's contributions, but we actually don't have any that's focused on people of color. And I said, I hear you, but my mission is to elevate the work of women and people of color. Because when that professor asked me to stand, he didn't say stand because you're Black. He said stand because you're Black and because you're a woman. And although the issues that women face are different from those that are of people of color, they are yielding very similar results. We're not paid the same. Yeah, we're not getting promoted the same. And so this is something critical that we need to address. So I would not move off of my mission, and ultimately that killed that deal. But it's fine that it prolonged creating this book that I think is powerful and important and necessary, And it's set to release this year in October as I step down as NOMA presidency. I'm going to release it at the NOMA conference. And so that's why I'm saying to people, you don't have to wait till a publisher comes to you or whomever. You can put yourself out there and start to document your own story, because then mm-hmm. it's content that then you can pull from. And just that act of being a historian of your own story is important. You don't have to wait for someone else to describe you.
Yeah.
And that's why I like to say it loud. Exhibitions with the library, it's a self-submitting process. You tell your story, you select what headshot, you say which project, you talk about your contributions. And this is the first step of empowering your voice and your importance in our entire environment, in our entire world. It also helped me develop another initiative called Say It With Media, which is asking publications, both digital, print, and broadcasts, to keep track and document how many women and people of color they're featuring in their content, and increasing it to 15% with a 5% increments every year.
And you're talking about shelter publications as well, like the ADs and the Dayzines and the, all of that
all
of the world.
Of it.
Yeah,
yes.
All of it, yeah.
But then I also ask them to use their resources to also unearth history and important information about us as well, because they have an ability to get information that we don't. And mm-hmm. I was getting so frustrated that social media was where I was learning so many critical facts about important figures. And I'm like, why did it take this Instagram post for me to understand that this person existed and that this is what they did?
I will say too, though, that again, to that first point about owning mm-hmm. your narrative, there's so many people who do not think their narrative is important.
Correct.
And that it remains hidden until great granddaughter comes along or grandson or whoever it is and says, you know what, my mom or my grandmom or my aunt did X or Y. And that's why we are getting this en masse right now, because there are so many young, and I think about young Black women in particular, who are rocking it, right? Who are out there with their platforms moving the narrative and the needle. And so I do think it's important to understand the value of your own story and how en masse the collective, the unified collective of those stories tips the needle on what we pay attention to.
That, and putting this book together, and I'm so proud of the content. You all are going to be like, wow. Like, I know this, but I also don't want it to just be an architecture community book. I want it to be a book that anyone who's impacted by their built environment picks this up and goes, oh, wow, I didn't understand was part of the planning and how highways cutting into my neighborhood actually disrupted and demolished a lot of thriving communities. Like, just understanding how architecture can and was used to harm, and how it also has been really a beautiful hero for a lot of communities. So how do we leverage that and understand that? So I really want to make sure that we stop, let's say, talking to just ourselves all the time and having important conversations with other individuals to understand how can we move that kind of that progress forward and disseminate the workload, that it's not the work of a few, but it's the requirements of everyone. And I know that's a very controversial thing to say, but that's why I don't consider myself an activist, which is about sharing information and getting people activated to get people aware and get people motivated, but more of an advocate who's happy to sit year in, year out, refining policies and procedures that hit and address community needs and issues, and then putting it in a way where no matter who's at the table, it's something that they have to follow. And for me, I'm down for the long game. I'm patient. I ain't going nowhere. We're going to make this happen.
We'll add that there's something about two in this moment, just allowing yourself to be. You are the advocate. You are the voice. You are, but even just simply allowing yourself to live a whole and fully expressed life is a form of activism in this moment. It's something that is the result of the work that our ancestors have done. But to show that you, to let the people who created the broken system do the work. Because it's not on us to do the work of a broken system. However, it is on us to be ourselves wholly so that we can move the conversation in the way that we want to. It doesn't have to be all action. I just want to put that out there.
One thing I'd say about like just being, I just want to tell two stories really quickly. Mm-hmm. Is the first is when I was expecting my son, almost 8 years ago, I used to religiously flat iron my hair. My hair was almost always straight. That was what professionalism looked like to me. That was what beauty looked like.
That's what we were told professionalism is.
Correct. And so I thought to myself, how can I tell this little one to love themselves if they're observing me spend about 3 hours every other Sunday transforming who I am, right? Mm-hmm. And not to not have that versatility and no shame to it, but I found that it was getting in the way of just being, right? Mm-hmm. I couldn't go outside when it's raining. I couldn't work out. I couldn't do all these things because I was trying to subscribe to this. And so I made a no heat pledge to my head. And no matter what was happening, whether I was meeting the president, whether I was going to be on TV, whatever it is, I had to wear my hair curly. And it mm-hmm. was a tough transition time for me to just get to know my hair and my head. Mm-hmm. And now, like, my hair is almost always in some type of curly, either pineapple updo or a fro, right? Like, that's my default. And so I say all that to say, when I share that story, so many people will come up to me and say, I just spent 2 hours this morning blow drying my hair because I wanted to be professional at this conference, or because I wanted to get this job at this job fair. But you just, like, being up there and talking about it. And at first, I didn't think it was such a big deal till I told that story one time. And then just the response that I got, I said, wow, that's mm-hmm. really important. The second story I'll say is that when I actually joined the NOMA board as historian, I had just had Xavier, my son, and his feeding time, I was trying to track with our agenda, and we were completely sliding. Like, the agenda was just not agendaizing the way it was supposed to. Yeah. And it just so happened that when it was my time to do the report was exactly when my husband at the time was bringing in my newborn for me to nurse. Mm-hmm. And so I ultimately was nursing X and reading my report out to the board. And again, something that I didn't think too big about, just like, this is his time, this is his meal, I need him to come get this meal from me. And this is my time to share the work that I have been doing for this quarter. And years later, people are like, oh my God, Pascal, you being in that boardroom with your baby just meant so much. And so there's so many board meetings, conferences that Xavier is with me, A, because I don't want to be apart from him for so long, but also I want people to know that you can be a president, you can mm-hmm. be a CEO, you can be an author, you can be a very hungry person and be a mom, and that it's possible. And again, it's just me being, but realizing really clearly that I don't need to subdivide myself. I'm not a pie that can only give this sliver or this percentage, that I show up whole. And sometimes that whole means a curly fro with my kid with me. Sometimes that whole is me doing no more work while I'm at work, at my office. Sometimes that work is protesting while working. Like, all of these things are not about today I can only be this part of me and that part of me. No, when I walk into a space, this is my mission. And all mm-hmm. of these things are part of that.
What is your wish for every other woman?
Is that they have the support they need to show up exactly the way they are without needing to feel to be perfect, but just to be themselves.
Be visible. Use your voice. Every other woman needs you to lead. Voice Lessons is co-produced, written, and spoken by me, Kim Cutable. It's also co-produced and edited by Sergio Miranda. You can find past episodes, show notes, and the cool stuff our guests recommend at voicelessonspodcast.com.